Okay, so what I want to do, as I said in the title, is I want to analyze the story of Rabbi Akiva's death, both as it appears in the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, in the two versions, in the two Talmuds. And I want to do this to understand Shema, because one of the things that I really enjoy teaching my students is Agadah. Right? The broadly speaking, the Talmud is divided into halachic material and then non-halachic material, which is normally referred to as Agadah, which includes ethical comments, which includes everything from medical advice to philosophical issues to psychological insights to biblical exegesis. And Agadah often complements and bolsters and provides framing for the halachic material. And in the case of Shema, the story of Rabbi Akiva's death, where he dies with the words of Shema on his lips, is presented in the Gemara seemingly as an explanation or as part of a broader rumination on the lessons of Shema. And the story is celebrated by Jews throughout history. It's been incorporated in different ways into our liturgy. We incorporate parts of it into the liturgy on Yom Kippurim, on Yom Kippur, and a version of it on Tisha B'Av as well. And the story of Rabbi Akiva's death, dying on the martyring himself with the word Echad, with the word, the final word of Shema on his lips, is also part of the background to the Jewish experience of Jews throughout the generations who have been forced to pay the ultimate price and give up their life to commit themselves to Judaism, who died with the words of Shema on their lips. And the story of Rabbi Akiva is in the background, knowing that this is a Jewish way to sort of capture the final moments of your life. And since the Gemara seems to frame our understanding of Shema with this story, and presents it, as I said, differently in the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, it's worth looking at this story to get a little bit of insight into how Chazal conceptualized the experience, the emotion, the psychology, the religious commitments that are captured by Shema. Parenthetically, I'll note that we'll see in the story how Rabbi Akiva dies seemingly in this very, very public way. And if you look on Tisha B'Av, Mizrahi, World Mizrahi had the keynote, had the different elegies that we say like on-site tours, like 5 to 10 minute little tours. And one of the tours was in Caesarea, was in Caesarea, where you can see it was the Kina that talks about the death of Rabbi Akiva in the stadium where it may be that Rabbi Akiva died. So you can see how his death would have been at the center of this, of essentially a stadium meant for the battles of the gladiators. If you want to try to imagine what this moment looked like. One more point of introduction is that in this particular shiur, I want to focus for the most part on an analysis of these stories given by Rabbi Norman Lamb. One second, my 2-year-old just walked in. Ezra, you should be going to sleep. You can say hello for a second, then you gotta go, okay? Say hello, and then go back. Okay, say hey. Okay. Okay, and, as Rabbi Lamb passed away just a few short weeks ago, And he wrote a this book on the Shema, using the Shema as a springboard to understand Jewish philosophy. I thought it was worth, in at least one of our shiurim, drawing on on his analysis. Okay, so with that, let us turn to the story as presented both in the Bavli and the Yerushalmi. The Bavli's translation is found on the source sheet. Now, in addition to the main source sheet, did the link to the Rabbi Lam pages also go out? Right, Kalman, those are also linked on the page.
Let me unmute myself. Yeah, sorry. I you know what? I don't know if they're on the page.
It's okay, like, so if I think they were. At any rate, he provides a translation of the Yerushalmi there, but I can read it or try to pull it up on my page also, because I know I sent it to you, so I should have it in an email that I can pull up as well. Okay, so let's turn to the story. So let me share my screen. Okay. So let's read back over the psukim one more time. The first paragraph, what we refer to as the first paragraph of Shema, appears here in Source 1. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. And you shall love God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your me'od, your might, your wealth. And these words that I command you today shall be in your heart. And you will speak about them and study them, as we talked about last week, to your children, when you sit, when you dwell in your home, when you walk on the path, when you're lying down and when you get up, and you'll tie them on your arm and on your head, and you'll tie them on the doorposts of your house, what we call mezuzah. And now, as I said, the Gemara often will present the halachic statements in context with a story, with an agadah to frame it. And if we want to understand the experience that we're supposed to have when we're involved in a mitzvah, when we're involved in the performance of a particular act, a ritual act, those stories are supposed to frame it. And when it comes to Shema, the most celebrated story is quite extreme. And this is the story as it appears in the Bavli. So in number 2, we get Va'ahavta et Adonai Elohecha. You should love God. Tanya. So we have a statement from a Braita, from a Tanitic source. Rabbi Eliezer Omer. Rabbi Eliezer says, Im ne'emar b'chol nafshecha, lama ne'emar b'chol me'odecha. If it already said you have to love God with all of your soul, you have to give up your life for God, then why would it have to say you have to love God with all of your money, with all of your might? Obviously, if you're willing to give up your life, you're willing to give up your money. And if you say with all your me'od, whatever that means, so maybe you don't need to say b'chol nafshecha, you don't have to say with all your life. So the Gemara responds, no, the point is that you have to understand that when you commit to God in the recital of Shema, the command to love God that is outlined in these psukim that we recite twice daily, the standard for what it means to commit yourself to God is that you're willing to give that which is most meaningful to you. And therefore, Ela im yesh lecha adam, if you have a person who values his life more than his money, more than his property, for him, you have to say that the extent to which you must love God includes giving up your life. And if you have a person who prefers his property to his life, so therefore, it has to say, love your God with all your property. The point being is that the obligation to love God that frames the recital of Shema, the standard to which you have to hold yourself, is that you love God to the point where you would be willing to give that which is most valuable to you in service of God, whatever that may be. If it's your life, then it's your life. If it's your property, it's your property. Now, this doesn't mean that if you don't get a chance to give up your life, that there's something lacking in your love of God, but the theoretical test for how much you love God and what you're committing to yourself to when you say those words is to give up whatever it is that is worth most to you. And with that in the background, the Gemara then brings in the statement of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva Omer, b'chol nafshecha. Let's just be clear. Rabbi Akiva says, what does it mean with your life? Afilu notel et nafshecha. Even if he takes your life. Now, I would note that there's a nuance here. Right? You could say that Rabbi Akiva is simply clarifying what Rabbi Eliezer said. Namely, Rabbi Eliezer said you have to be willing to give up nafshecha, your life. And Rabbi Akiva clarifies, yeah, that's what it means. Right? That you have to be willing to give up your life. But if you read Rabbi Akiva carefully, and I think this will work within the story that we'll read, Rabbi Akiva isn't just saying that the extent to which you love God is such that you have to be willing to give up your life. Right? The framing is ever so different. And he says, afil notel et nafshecha. Right? Even if he takes your life. Now, I think what he's coming to add is that not only are you obligated, if necessary, to give up your life, but there's a psychological point that Rabbi Akiva is touching on, which is, let's say you get to the point where your life is endangered and you have to give up your life in order to express your commitment to God and His Torah. There are two reasons at that moment why you might not give up your life. Right? One is because, well, multiple. Right? One, you could just be scared. Okay. But one could be that, look, I just don't love God enough. So I'm not willing to give up my life. Or my love can't overpower my fear, or some variation on that theme. Or it could be that, look, in a vacuum, if you asked me, do I love God enough that I would be willing to give up my life for God? I might have said the answer is yes. But then when I'm placed in the situation that God puts my life at risk because I'm committed to Him, it might be that that situation itself is what makes me question my commitment. Because I might say at that moment, if God loved me back, then why is He forcing me to suffer to keep His Torah? Why is He forcing me to suffer in order to keep the commitment that I made to Him? Shouldn't He, I don't know, perform a miracle and save my life like He did with Avram in the well-known Midrash, where he was thrown into the fiery furnace and came out alive? Or Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, who were thrown into the fiery furnace in Daniel. And perhaps what Rabbi Akiva is adding is it's not just that you have to be willing to give up your life, but that you have to love God so much that even if He puts you in an inscrutable situation where you can't possibly fathom how at that moment God's love is reciprocated, right? You love God and You don't see how the situation you're in can possibly express that God reciprocates that commitment. Even at that moment, you have to be willing to say, I might not understand it, but I believe that God reciprocates the love that I have for him. And I think that might be what Rabbi Akiva is adding. And with that background, right, with the background of saying that the mitzvah that begins the second verse in Shema, V'ahavta Hashem Elokecha, meaning that I have to love God to the point where I'd be willing to give up everything for him. And that even if I'm put in a situation where the reality that love is reciprocated is called into question, and I have to get myself to the point where I have faith in God, that he really does reciprocate it, and therefore I'm not going to falter no matter how hard it gets, that background and the intensity of that commitment, again, God forbid we should ever be in that situation, but the intensity of that commitment should at least influence how seriously we take it when we recite the verses in the first paragraph of Shema. Okay, I'll look at the chat and then we'll continue in the story. One second. Why is the chat not opening for me? Oh, here we go. There we go, I got it. Okay, so we have two questions. One is, what about the obligation and you shall live by them? Okay, so the Talmud does say that the only time one's obligated to give up his life for God is in either the big three, right? The big three cardinal sins, to not murder, to not commit idolatry, or not be involved in illicit sexual activity. And the other 610 mitzvot, so you are, you're not expected to, for Tosfot, or for the Rambam, not allowed to give up your life, which we talked about at the very end of last week's shiur. Now, so we can take this two ways. One is to say, so the expectation that you give up your life for God is only in those three mitzvot. And you're right, in everything else you're not expected to give up your life. The second way, and I think this emerges from the Chinuch, but we don't have time to prove this right now, is a little bit more nuanced than that, is to say, look, it's true that legally God only expects you to give up your life for three mitzvot. But that doesn't change the fact that you have to be the type of person who would be willing to give up your life if God had expected it for anything. That in truth, he doesn't, because he loves you, and he would rather you live than violate. He would rather you violate the Torah and live than die for one of the other mitzvot. But that doesn't change the fact that you, as a person, should love God enough that had he expected you to love him enough to give up your life for any mitzvah, you would have been willing to do it, right? And that's very different, right? That's saying, look, practically you don't have to give up your life, and maybe you're not even allowed to. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't be the type of person who's that invested in your commitment with God. What just happened? Oop. Okay, I lost you for a second, but I'm back. The second question, though, I went out for a second, so I lost the second chat. I think the chat was, the second one I saw was about Sarah and Avram. So there is a Midrashic tradition that Sarah dies over the shock of Avram having attempted to sacrifice Yitzchak at the Akedah. The question of whether to the extent to which your sacrifice and your religious commitments can affect others, that is a topic that I think we cannot touch today. It is a good question, but I think we have to leave that on the side. And there was another question that I didn't get a chance to see before I got cut off for a second, and now the chat is cleared. So
I'll tell you. Could it not be understood that we will commit our lives to Hashem to live by Halacha in a goodly, godly way? I'm not sure what that question means exactly, but commit. In other words, the psukim just mean to live in a proper way, but not to give up our life.
Right, and that's why. Right, so that's why I think this story is important, because, you know, if all the pasuk meant was, look, give your life in the metaphorical sense, like, you know, wake up every day and live by what God says, and go to sleep every night committed to what God said. So I think it would lack a certain oomph, right? It would lack a certain gravitas that the story we're about to read leaves in the back of our mind. Now, it may be, and we hope that for all of us, what God will expect from us is just the level of love of waking up in the morning, wake up in the morning, go to sleep at night, committed to God, to doing good things, to davening, to doing chesed, right, to doing kind acts, etc. But the commitment that we'll have, even in those day-to-day expressions of our commitment with God, will be totally different if we know in the back of our mind that God expects so much more love, right? So much more commitment, right? Meaning, again, to give a mashal, right? We hope that we all live healthy lives, and when it's time for us to go after 120 years, you know, we die in our sleep with no pain and no suffering. That's what we hope. And therefore, we hope that our commitment to our spouse will be that we live life together, we raise our children, we go, you know, we work to support each other, etc. We hope that our love will never have to express itself in one of us taking care of our spouse in a sick, bedridden, you know, state, you know, God forbid, with dementia where they don't recognize us, etc. We hope that it never comes to that. But if we didn't believe that our spouse would stand by us when things got hard, that would probably upset us even when we're decades away from that reality. Because it's the knowledge that we are in a relationship where our spouse would be committed to us no matter what that imbues the daily, not dramatic, not super painful commitments of life with meaning, because we love each other no matter what. So now, right, I'm, you know, raising my children with someone who I believe would be there for me even, right, if it was really, really hard, even though right now, you know, everything is good. The same is true with God, that we hope we never get to the point where we have to give up our life. But in the back of our mind, we have to know that the extent of our commitment, the level of love that is required of us, is the type of love that we would even give up our life. Okay, we're moving slowly, so we do got to get to the story here. So the Gemara then tells us, let's look at the English of the story, because it'll go a little bit quicker. So we are here. So the sages taught, one time after the Bar Kokhba rebellion, the evil empire of Rome decreed that Israel may not engage in the study and practice of Torah.
Puppis Ben Yehuda. Your screen again.
Sorry.
Just let you.
Sorry, that okay.
And maybe just make it a little bit wider so.
Yeah,
can,
I'll. Okay, I will expand it. Here we go.
Extend it and read it in English. And yeah, and then you can leave all the questions till the end. That's what I would recommend.
Yeah. Okay, so let me just close this. Sure. Okay. Wide enough? Good?
Yes.
Okay, good. Okay.
Much better.
So, the sages taught. One time after the Bar Kokhba rebellion, the evil empire of Rome decreed that Israel may not engage in the study and practice of Torah. Pappas ben Yehuda came and found Rabbi Akiva, who was convening assemblies in public and engaging in Torah study. Pappas said to him, Akiva, are you not afraid of the empire? Rabbi Akiva answered him, I'll relate a parable. To what can this be compared? It's like a fox walking along a riverbank when he sees fish gathering and fleeing from place to place. The fox said to them, from what are you fleeing? They said to him, we're fleeing from the nets that people cast upon us. He said to them, do you wish to come up onto dry land and we'll reside together, just as my ancestors resided with your ancestors? The fish said to him, you are the one of whom they say he's the cleverest of animals? You are not clever. You're a fool. If we're afraid in the water, our natural habitat, which gives us life, then in a habitat that causes our death, all the more so. The moral is, so too, we Jews, now that we sit and engage in Torah study, about which it is written, for that it is your life and the length of your days, we fear the empire to this extent, if we proceed to sit idle from its study, as its abandonment is the habitat that causes our death, all the more so will we fear the empire. The sages said, not a few days passed until they seized Rabbi Akiva and incarcerated him in prison, and seized Pappus ben Yehuda and incarcerated him alongside him. Rabbi Akiva said to him, Pappus, who brought you here? Pappus replied, happy are you, Rabbi Akiva, for you were arrested on the charges of engaging in Torah study. Woe unto Pappus who was seized on the charge of engaging in idle matters. The Gemara relates, when they took Rabbi Akiva out to be executed, it was time for the recitation of Shema. And they were raking his flesh with iron combs, and he was reciting Shema, thereby accepting upon himself the yoke of heaven. His student said to him, our teacher, even now as you suffer, you recite Shema? He said to them, all my days I have been troubled by this verse, with all your soul, meaning, even if God takes your soul. I said to myself, when will the opportunity be afforded me to fulfill this verse? Now that it has been afforded me, shall I not fulfill it? He prolonged his uttering of the word, one, echad, until his soul left his body as he uttered his final word, one, echad. Now, parenthetically, for those who are into pronunciation issues, it's very hard to drag out echad, the dalet, as we have it, the D sound, in as Rabbi Akiva was pronouncing it, and this is how some Svaradim will still pronounce it, Yemenites and Moroccans, the Dalid without the dot in the middle, without the Dagesh, is not pronounced as a D, it's pronounced more as a the, like a TH sound, in which case you can drag it out, right? You can't drag out a D, right? Echad doesn't work. But Echad, right? You could hold as long as you want. Right, because it just sort of rolls off the tongue. That's probably the more correct way of pronouncing it. That's just necessary to understand what it means that he dragged out the word echad. At that moment, a voice descended from heaven and said, happy are you, Rabbi Akiva, that your soul left your body as you uttered one. So I want to make a few comments on this story. Before we get to the comparison in the Yerushalmi. The first point, and this is something we talked about last week, is that before we get to the famous death scene of Rabbi Akiva, the story that precedes that, even though technically it's not connected to the exegesis of the word, Echad, and V'ahavta Hashem Elokecha, I think it is critical to understanding the story and what is demanded by the love of God. So if we think about the story, there's two parts. The second part is where Rabbi Akiva actually fulfills the literal understanding of the verse as he understands it. Love God with all your soul, v'ahavta Hashem Elokecha b'chol nafshecha, even if he takes your life. But in the first half of the story, Rabbi Akiva has a dispute or discussion with Pappus ben Yehuda, where he explains to him why he's willing to risk his life for the study of Torah, which is, as we talked about last week, not one of the cardinal sins. And his explanation is, because if I don't learn Torah, if I'm not engaged in a godly life, then I'm already dead. Right, I'm not in my habitat. I'm a fish out of water. Literally, right? That's his story. I'm a fish out of water. And I think that that first half of the story isn't just the backdrop to the second half, to the martyrdom, right? Because he was studying Torah, that's why he got caught, that's why he got killed. That half of the story, I think, is there to remind us that Bichol nafshecha, with all your life, isn't just about literally giving up your life. As again, as I said with the mashal of the married couple, if I know my wife will be there for me, even if, God forbid, I'm sick and, you know, stuck in bed and not of my complete faculties, then all the normal parts of life, the easier parts of life, right, raising a family together while we're healthy and working to support our family and buying our house and all those things, is imbued with a much deeper meaning, because I know that the level of commitment is that much higher. And you see that with Rabbi Akiva, even before he gives up his life, he simply describes that the way he relates to his commitment to Torah is not just one of obligation. It's one of, look, I can't imagine my life without it. Right? My life without Torah is empty. I'm essentially dead without Torah to begin with. And that's why I'm willing to risk my life for it. Right? He doesn't give a formal explanation. When he actually gives up his life, he says, oh, I've fulfilled my obligation of loving God b'chol nafshecha. But even before he gets there, he says, look, the reason I'm willing to put my life in danger is because, again, to put it in the mashal, or to put it in the words of the pasuk, he's saying, look, I love God and his Torah and the way of life he's given me so much that, what are you telling me? Another fear should tell me I should live a life devoid of Torah. Maybe technically I'm allowed to. But what would my life be? I'd be a fish out of water. And I think that that first half of the story is equally critical to understanding what it means to love God in Shema. It's that, before we get to the question of whether you're willing to martyr yourself, it's that you're supposed to love God and the way of life he's given you so much that you just realize that to live a life that isn't tied up in that lifestyle is just empty for you. It's just a living death. And again, the same way we would feel if our spouse was suddenly cut out of our lives, or our children were, God forbid, cut out of our lives, we would feel a gaping hole. And we'd be willing to possibly, right, endanger, right, think about how many times, I know this is true in Israel, but how many, this is not quite as extreme, but it'll get the point across. Right? How often has the government, does the government here have to warn people? We know you love your grandparents. We know that you'd even be willing to put yourself in danger, or your grandparents are willing to put themselves in danger to see their children and their grandchildren. But don't do it, because if you have coronavirus, it might not affect you. But if you go visit your grandparents in their house, right, with the numbers as high as they are in Israel, I know in Canada it's a little bit better than it is here, right, you're putting their life in danger. But why are they saying that over and over again? Because they know that the love that family members have to each other is such that sometimes you're willing to do something that you know is not smart. Right? They know that a grandparent, if they haven't seen their family, their children, their grandchildren in months, might be willing to have their children and grandchildren come. And once they come, they're not going to think necessarily, which they should, let's meet in a park, let's meet in the backyard, right? They come and suddenly it's like, look, life isn't worth living if they don't come into my house. But when they're warning them, don't give in to that, that's because they recognize that when people are really in love, sometimes they do things that are actually dangerous. And Rabbi Akiva is basically that person. He's saying, look, I know that it's dangerous to learn Torah, but what is my life worth if, for the foreseeable future, right? The Romans are in charge for hundreds and hundreds of years. They don't know when this is going to end. If my entire life is going to be lived without Torah, why am I living? So sure, I'll be willing to risk my life. And that, right, background to the story, I think, is trying to inculcate what exactly it means to love God, to really feel that if we couldn't express our relationship with God in this world, it wouldn't be worth living. And with that background, then the Gemara takes the next step, which is, and sometimes you want to know what it's really going to look like. Sometimes it's not just, you know, risk your life because you're so committed Sometimes it might even mean that you actually have to give up your life. But again, if you read the story carefully, I don't think it's just saying you have to risk your life. If you read it carefully, the students say to Rabbi Akiva, wait a second, you're telling me that God allowed you to get captured by the Romans, and they're not just killing you, but they're torturing you. And you still love God? You'll still say Shema? Really? This hasn't called into question the reciprocal nature of your relationship with God? And Rabbi Akiva responds, no. My entire life, I said that I'm committed to God no matter what, and that I will believe until the last moment, no matter what happens, that God is there, that the God is there. And therefore, the fact that I don't hesitate at this moment proves that my commitment was genuine. And retroactively, it shows just how much and just how real that relationship with God was. Now, there are other points to unpack here, but before we do, I want to go to the Yerushalmi for a moment. If we don't get past the Yerushalmi, that'll be fine. I can summarize the other things I'm outside, but I want to read the version in the Yerushalmi as well. Now, again, I'm not sure whether the link went out from Rabbi Lamb on this, but I'll read you Rabbi Lamb's translation of this version here in the Yerushalmi. Rabbi Akiva was brought to trial before the tyrant Rufus, Turnus Rufus. The time for the recitation of the Shema arrived, and Rabbi Akiva read the Shema and smiled. Tyrant Rufus said to him, "Old man, either you are a magician, and therefore do not feel the torture, or you ignore suffering," perhaps implying that he was a masochist. Said Rabbi Akiva to him, "May your breath leave you. I am neither a magician nor one who is indifferent to pain. It is rather that all my life I recited the Shema and was troubled by one verse, wondering when I would have the opportunity to fulfill the three elements in it. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your possessions. I've loved him with all my heart and I've loved him with all my possessions. But I was not yet tested as to my soul. Now that I have reached this stage where I am to surrender all your soul, and the time for the reading of Shema has arrived, I shall not be distracted from loving him. That is why I recite and smile." He barely finished speaking these words when his soul soared upwards. So this is the version of the Yerushalmi. Now, there are some important differences here that we can highlight, but I think the most fascinating is the following comment that Rabbi Lamb picks up on. In the Bavli, why did Rabbi Akiva recite Shema as he died? Right? Why did he recite Shema when he died? So in the Bavli, Rabbi Akiva recited Shema when he died because he was dying for the sake of God and he was looking for a verse that would express his commitment. Why in the Yerushalmi did Rabbi Akiva recite Shema as he died? Because it was Zman Kriyat Shema. It was the time to say Shema. Right? It was time to daven Shacharit. It was 8:30 in the morning. Right? Whatever. If he was davening late, I don't know when they carried out their horrendous tortures. I don't know. I don't know if it was Vatikan. I don't know if it was sunrise. I don't know. It was time to daven, and that's why he said Shema. And this, Rabbi Lamb picks up on, as critical to understanding, right, this story. Right, I'll read you some of what he says. He says, a further and more important difference. The Babylonian version, highlights the time. Wait, was this in the Bavli also? One second. Sorry, both of them have the time of the Shema. Right, both of them have the time of the Shema, but they highlight it differently. Right, the Babylonian version highlights the time for reading the Shema as an essential element of the tale. It focuses on the biblical proof text as the source for requiring such an act of martyrdom. Note the wording of the text. When the Romans took Rabbi Akiva to execute him, it was time for the reading of the Shema. The rabbis here reinforce the idea that Rabbi Akiva's invocation of the phrase with all your soul and his death upon reciting Echad teaches not only that his martyrdom coincided with the reading of the Shema, but that martyrdom itself is an aspect of reading the Shema, as Rabbi Akiva taught all his life and ultimately with his death. In the Jerusalem Talmud's version, the reading of the Shema, though important, is not quite central to the dramatic tension of the story. When the time for reading the Shema arrives fortuitously, as Rabbi Akiva is being interrogated and tortured by Tarnas Rufus, Rabbi Akiva uses this very moment to flaunt a sardonic smile and heroically defy the tyrant. But Rabbi Akiva's death was primarily a fulfillment not of the mitzvah of reading the Shema, but that of accepting martyrdom. This mitzvah applies to all times and places and is independent of any recitation. Rabbi Lam argues the following. He says, if you look, and he flips it, he says, in the Bavli, well, let's start with the Yerushalmi. In the Yerushalmi, it happens to be the time for Shema. But the drama in the story unfolds because Rabbi Akiva is involved in this taunt with the Roman tyrant, Tarnas Rufus. And he's dying and he gives him this smile, right? I laugh in the face of danger, right? I spit in the face of death, right? He's defiant. And as part of his defiance, he says Shema, because it's the time for Shema. But the drama in the story is about this dialogue between him and the Roman officer, right? The Roman officer wants to crush his spirit, and Rabbi Akiva turns to him and says, nothing will crush my spirit. I will commit myself to God no matter what. In the Bavli, there is no interlocutor, at least when he says, right, that before. There's an interlocutor after, his students. He says Shema because it's time for Shema. And what Rabbi Lam suggests is that there's two very different perspectives going on here. The Yerushalmi is primarily a story of martyrdom. Is of someone coming and saying, look, I will live as a Jew, I will die as a Jew. I don't care what you say. You want to quash my pride in being Jewish? Good luck. And he mocks him. And Tarnas Rufus looks at him and he says, what are you doing? How could you be laughing at me at this moment? Are you a masochist? Are you crazy? And he says, no, I'm just a believer. And as part of his shoving it in Tarnas Rufus's face, right, is proving that he'll die a proud Jew, he says, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. The story is fundamentally one of martyrdom. And Shema is the right verse for him to pick to capture his defiant martyrdom, his defiant denial of everything that Rome represented and everything that Rome wanted to quash. But Rabbi Lam suggests that's not what's happening in the Bavli. In the Bavli, Rabbi Akiva says Shema because it's time to say Shema. Meaning, the heroism of Rabbi Akiva in the Bavli isn't that he's willing to stand up to the Roman. It's that no matter how bad things get, if it's time to say Shema, if it's time to do that everyday little thing that he does, right? That recitation, that statement, God, I love you, he'll do it no matter what's happening. Right? And what's the difference? Right? The difference is again, to go back to the, right, to go back to the mashal, right, if you have someone who every morning he prepares, you know, he gets out of bed 5 minutes before his wife to make sure that he prepares her coffee, right, that's how he expresses that he loves her. Right? Now that's very easy when he's 20 and he's 30 and he's 40 and he's 50. But then he's, you know, 85 and he has arthritis and, you know, getting out of bed is difficult. Right? And it's painful and his arthritis is acting up and he still manages to pull him. Now it doesn't take 5 minutes to get out of bed first. It takes him 20 minutes to make sure that he can slowly go down the stairs and prepare that coffee. Right? It's the same act. But the drama, right, the drama in that act, so to speak, is that if he still gets up and goes down the stairs and prepares the coffee for his wife 5 minutes before she gets up, retroactively you know that every time he prepared that coffee, that's how much he loved his wife. It happened to be easy when he was 30. But the fact that he's still doing it when he's 85 and suffering from arthritis and it's hard to go down the stairs shows you, right, that the little thing was imbued with so much love, but the drama is in the coffee, right? The drama is the coffee. And I think what Rabbi Lam is getting at is that for the Bavli, you think it's a martyrdom story, but it's not. The Yerushalmi is a martyrdom story, right? Yerushalmi is the story of someone coming and saying, I will die defined as a Jew no matter what. And he mocks the Roman. And as part of his mock, he says Shema. But in the Bavli, the reason he says Shema is because it's time to say Shema. Right? It's time to say Shema. And I said Shema every day of my life. And I said Shema because that was the way. I said to God, I love you. And every day I said to Shema, I love you. I love you when it's easy, but I would love you if it's hard, and I would love you if I had to give up my life for you, and I would love you if you put me in a situation where I had to give up my life for you. But I always wonder, did I really mean it? Right? Every day when I said Shema, it's so easy, but I believe that I packed that little innocuous act with so much love, and I believed that I would do it even when it got hard. And now I'm dying. But, you know, every day I got up and I davened at the 7 o'clock shacharit. And now it's 7 o'clock. I would be saying Shema right now. And now I'm not going to say it? If I don't say it right now, then that proves that my claim, every time I said Shema, that I love God so much, that it was imbued with that intensity, it's just not true. So of course I'm going to say Shema now. But it's almost as if, the way Rabbi Lam claims, is that in the Yerushalmi, the drama is a drama of martyrdom. But in the Bavli, the drama is the drama of Shema. But the drama isn't the martyrdom is the backdrop. Rabbi Akiva is coming and saying, look, again, back to our mashal. Every day when I prepared that coffee, I told my wife, look, I know you like coffee, and the way that I show you I love you is by getting up 5 minutes earlier and having that coffee waiting for you. But you should know that I love you so much that I will be doing this when I'm 40 and when I'm 50 and when I'm 60 and when I'm 70 and 80 and 90. I will do it. And when that person is in fact 90 years old and he does it, it retroactively shows you that he meant every word he said when he prepared that coffee every single morning. And the way the Bavli presents it, according to Rabbi Lam, is that that's the drama. Right? Someone said before, isn't our commitment to God the living a life of good deeds and Torah and prayer and commitment to God? And the answer is 100%. We don't have to be martyrs. We hope we'll never have to be martyrs. The reason that the Gemara tells these dramatic stories of Rabbi Akiva giving up his life for Shema is not to tell us that we should dream of being martyrs. It's to tell us that every day, that simple act of saying Shema, which is essentially us saying, God, I love you, Ve'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha, B'chol levavcha, b'chol nafshecha, b'chol me'odecha, that I love you is not just, right, a casual I love you. It's an I love you infused with the knowledge that I love you, God, and I'm in it, and everything I do, all the little things, they may be little, but just know that the depth of the love that permeates the everyday actions of saying Shema is so great, because if it came to that point where it was hard and I had to give up my life, I would do it. I hope I don't have to. But know that even the simple act every day of saying Shema, of saying I love you, that's a real, deep, serious I love you, even if I never have to show you how much I love you, right? Even if I never have to actually put it to the test, I want you to know what it means. And Rabbi Lamb goes on, and again, we don't have so much time, so I'll summarize what you have here in the following sources. Rabbi Lamb notes that, in fact, what I just said seems to be subject to two different traditions in the commentaries. Because there are some commentaries who understand from Rabbi Kiva's comments that you should pursue martyrdom, right? That we actually celebrate not martyrdom per se. That what we learn from Bekiva's life is that at some level, deep down, we should hope that we get to live our life as martyrs. And that, Rabbi Lamb claims, is essentially the Yerushalmi, right? Where the Yerushalmi is saying, right, this martyrdom scene is celebrated because it's martyrdom, right? Because we love to see someone who's willing to stare the enemy in the face, even at the pain of death. But then he argues that the simple reading of the Bavli is not that. Is that it's not that we're celebrating martyrdom. We're celebrating Shema. We're celebrating that statement every morning of us saying to God, I love you. We hope we never get to the point of martyrdom. We only talk about martyrdom so we'll understand what exactly you mean and how deeply you mean those words, I love you, in Shema. And, you know, he notes, and if you can look through these sources, that he goes through several, but I'll just read you one. Right, he quotes the Shalah, who says, one should not think that because martyrdom is a great mitzvah, therefore I will pursue it diligently, in the same way that one must diligently pursue every other mitzvah. And I will try to create a situation that will result in my martyrdom, etc. One who acts in this matter is guilty of forfeiting his life. The mitzvah of martyrdom applies only to a case where the violation of one of the three commandments requiring martyrdom was forced upon him by others. Only then shall he sanctify the name and fear to be killed rather than violate one of these commandments. And Rabbi Lamb continues, that is, we must not seek out opportunities to die a martyr's death. Such active solicitation of martyrdom is a disguised form of suicide and must be discouraged. We can only conjecture about the historical circumstance that may have inspired this vigorous condemnation of proactive martyrdom. Right? But his point is that what you learn from the Bavli's presentation is that we acknowledge that it might come to that. And we express to God that if it came to that, we'd be willing to do that. But that's not because we want to live that life. It's because we want our day-to-day life, the saying Shema, that simple I love you every morning, to be infused with the commitment that we say to God, look, I hope it doesn't get there, but if it did, just know I love you so much. And I think, again, that's why the first half of the Agadat and the Bavli is so critical. Rabbi Kiva's first statement, which is, look, the reason I keep studying Torah is not because of a formal reason. It's just because without it, I'm a fish out of water. Right? It's a reflexive statement. It's, look, God, I keep learning even when I'm in danger because I love you. I just love you. I can't imagine my life without you. So sure, if it came to the point where I have to give up my life, I would do it. But that just tells you how much I loved you when I did the little things day in and day out, when I said Shema, right? When I davened every day, when I learned, when I did chesed, when I did acts of kindness, all those things. And I think, and I, again, as I started with, the point of Agadah is to frame and fill in the experience of the ritual acts that we do. And what I think this story is coming to do is, again, is to tell us that, yes, ideally, as the Bavli presents it, the way we serve God is the normal things. Every morning we wake up and we say, Shema Yisrael, God, I believe in you, I love you. I'm going to live a life committed to you. I'm going to study your Torah. I'm going to pray. I'm going to do acts of kindness. I'm going to celebrate Shabbat and the holidays. And I'm going to do all those things. And they're easy. They're beautiful. I love them. And I do them as an act of love. But just know that in the back of my mind, I would do it even if it was hard. I do them now while they're easy, and I'm so glad they're easy. But God, I love you, and I would do them even if they're hard. I know what Rabbi Kiva had. In the back of my mind, I know that Rabbi Kiva, when it came time for Shema, he said Shema even though he was dying, because he said, look, I said Shema every other day. I showed God I love him every other day by saying these words. I said I would do it no matter how hard it got. Now it's hard. So now I'm going to do it. And retroactively, I'm going to show you that those simple acts, those simple statements of I love you and I'm committed to you, and that I'm committed no matter what, they were true. So again, as Ray Lam argues, there are two traditions. But let's take the tradition that he argues is dominant in the Bavli. We don't want martyrdom. But we tell these dramatic stories to remind us how much love you can infuse into what seems to you like a simple act. You think you're just saying to God, I love you? Yeah, but you're saying to God, I love you, and if you would say it, even while dying, then it means a heck of a lot, even when it's just you davening quietly, peacefully in shul or in your house if you can't make it to shul during COVID-19 or whatever it might be. And in fact, therefore, the story is a celebration of the commitment to God that we have in the everyday. The martyrdom story just tells us how deep our commitments in the everyday really are, even if we never gave a moment to really think about it. Okay, I only have 2 minutes left, so I'll take like one question. I'll stay on after, but I always have to end before the time to at least give time for questions before the time is done. I saw someone in the chat ask for my email. It is at the top of the source sheet. You are free to email me questions afterwards. It's just jzeering at migdalhatorah.org. My old email from when I was in the Kollel works also, which is jzeering@toronoftorah.com. Both of those work. I check both of those. So if you have more extended questions, I'm happy for you to email me, and I will answer there. But yeah, if you have the source sheets, it's there. I can copy it into the chat also. But I'll take questions in the minute or so I have left, and I'll stick around. That's okay. I see another one. Right, keep it as a soldier. Yes, exactly. Right, meaning I agree with that statement that that it's like a soldier who, right? Yes. Okay. Okay. If we have any other questions, I will take them. You can either do it in the chat or you can unmute yourself and ask me. Otherwise, otherwise.
I'll throw out something if anybody has. You want it? We alluded to this at the end of last week. Would you tie in the Bavli, the Rishami, to the debate between the Rambam and Balei HaTosfot, what their martyrdom is?
Yeah, I think you would, right? Meaning, I think, right, and if you look here, again, we didn't get a chance to look at it inside, but if you look at the Nitziv, he ties it in to the Rambam, right, and tries to grapple with this. I do think it would, right, meaning you have some statements here that go much more in the direction that you should look for opportunities to give up your life. And here, the Torah Tamima here says, and he bases himself on the Yerushalmi, here, Vidad, al piyam of war, kind of Yerushalmi, shekol yomav shir Bikiva yim mishtokek lamud al Kiddush Hashem. Right? Rabbi Kiva seemed to have wanted to die al Kiddush Hashem. He always wanted it. And I think you're right, that if you hold like Tosfot, that you're allowed to give up your life for any mitzvah. So it's much easier to say that we specifically want to give up our lives. Not just we can, but we want to. The Rambam, who says, no, it's only three mitzvah that you're even allowed to, would say, look, right, it's an obligation, but it's not something you look for, right? For Tosfot, if I wanted to give up my life for even the smallest mitzvah, I'd be allowed to. I mean, Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik does note this, that Tosfot, both rules that you're allowed to give up your life for any mitzvah, but many of the Balei HaTosfot tell stories of people who seem to have celebrated martyrdom and killed themselves and their children during the Crusades and acts of martyrdom. And those do seem to be connected, right? A outright celebration of martyrdom. And obviously, if you think that martyrdom is an ideal you should pursue, it's also something you should be allowed to pursue. If you think it's something that you should be willing to do if necessary, but you don't want to pursue, so then you would be much more limited and be more likely to say, like the Rambam, if you don't have to give up your life and you do, it's suicide. But again, in these sources, he notes that it's a, these are the sources that are Lamb quotes, that it seems to be a machloket and then it's Siv and the Erchav Davar and the Tzar Tzmima. And if you're interested later on, Rabbi Benny Lau notes that it also may seem to be a tension between the different Tanaitic Midrashim, those that come from the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Akiva and those that come from the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Ishmael. But we didn't get a chance to get to that analysis, but I made a note of it here at the end of the source sheet, that you do seem to see different perspectives in the Midrashim that are attributed to Rabbi Akiva's Beit Midrash and those that are explicitly from Rabbi Ishmael's Beit Midrash. So it could be that these two perspectives are Bavli Yerushalmi or Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Ishmael, Tosfot Rambam, right? There may be sort of recurring opposing themes throughout Jewish intellectual history.
There are a couple of questions in the chat box now. You see, once we start with one.
Okay, let's see 1 second. The injury of the Yerushalmi is the danger of extreme treason. Yes, right? Meaning the danger of a seeking out martyrdom is that a life that is celebrating martyrdom, right, might be overall more extreme in a way that is unhealthy. That's definitely true. Even the Bavli is pretty extreme, it's definitely true that you don't want to go too extreme, but both the Bavli and the Yerushalmi would, I think, push you to think about commitment to God in ways that might be a bit more intense than the average person is willing to think about them, right? Meaning, there is a balance. It's not... There is a limit, but on the other hand, the limit is not necessarily where we might initially be comfortable with. And that, I think, is a... is a shear for another time, and especially the implied question here, which is the balance of the love of God and the love of family, which is a very complicated one, though in the Torah has a pretty clear answer, which is that the love of God does trump the love of family. It just does, right? That may sound extreme, but the Torah in at least one instance makes that 100% clear, besides for the Akedah, which I don't want to get into, which is complicated, but in this past week's Parsha, in the discussion of the inciter, of the Mesit, it says, if the person who loves you, your family member, tries to lead you astray, don't have mercy on them, because they're trying to lead you away from God. Now again, that's an extreme case, but the Torah is telling you that if it came to that, right, it would be God over your family. It's only one case in the whole Torah, where your kid tries, or your parent, your spouse, tries to get you to worship idolatry. But in theory, that level of commitment is there. Is the word here said by Turner's Rav is in the Bavli Yerushalmi version? The word
Cheresh, I think they mean, Cheresh.
Oh.
The story in Shabbos on Elazar ben Arah, but I'm not sure the connection.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I'd have to think about those. Right, those connections. Is it encouraging suicide? So again, that's Chaim Soloveitchik's article where he says in the Balei HaTosfot it did seem to have gone to an extreme where it went from being overly calm with accepting martyrdom to almost a celebration of martyrdom, and that's what the Rambam is pushing back on. But he notes that that seems to have been a historical response to the Crusades, and even later in the Tosfot, right, they seem to have pulled back because the brunt of Jewish tradition pushes away from a celebration of martyrdom and suicide. But there are voices in the tradition that go more in that direction. That's for sure. Again, the Sarah question, I think we'll have to follow up by email, right? The question of an innocent person suffering is complicated, though it's, you know, it's definitely true that innocent people can get caught up in this, but it definitely complicates it. And yes, Kibud Av Va'Em, right, the fact that the Gemara says that Kibud Av Va'Em does not apply, right, respecting your parents does not apply if they tell you to go against the Torah, does in a much less extreme way indicate that when there's a conflict between instructions of your parents and of God, God wins. Right, that's obviously that's a much less extreme. That's just saying, look, you and your parents are both theoretically committed to God, and therefore they can't tell you to break the law. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't have commitment to your parents, it just means that there are limits. The same way we would say that if your parents tell you to break the law, right, we agree you should listen to the law, we agree that you should listen to your parents, but if you break the law because your parents told you, there will be consequences, right? That's just the reality. Irene, I do encourage you to email me afterwards, though, because I am happy to talk about the innocent suffering question, but like I said, I do think that is a much more complicated topic. And again, it has a lot of implications, right? Meaning that midrashic tradition is really pushing you, but it's a bit of an interesting one, right? Because it's not one where he knowingly gave up his Sarah; she died accidentally, right? Right, meaning tragically, but accidentally, right? Meaning, you'd really have to think, what is the midrash getting at when it says that about? Honestly, right, it could be, I'll just leave with this for now, it could be that the Midrash is telling you that, look, don't have a Pollyanna view of religious commitment. Don't think that just because you're doing the right thing, that it won't, I mean, in the end of the day, sometimes the answer is, we don't want it to happen, but if you think that it could never happen, then you're missing the complexity of life. We all know that when we do good things, there can be unintended consequences, and it could hurt people who are innocent. And, you know, it could be a hard-nosed look and just say, look, you know, sometimes you may not realize the consequences and it might hurt you, right? You know, it could be the Midrash is telling us that, right? Meaning, it's not that Avram meant it to happen, it's that it was the consequence and he had to live with it. Meaning, it could just be the Midrash telling you that sometimes living out commitment to life will have costs that you didn't realize. And, you know, but again, I think it should have more thought, and really, I do encourage you to email me, and I'll give it some more thought. Like, and anyone else also, I put my email in the chat, it's on the top of the source sheet. Please email me if you have follow-up questions, and I cannot promise I have the answer to it, but I will say that I will do my best to think about the questions with you, and if I have thoughts, share them. You know, I can't promise to have the right answers or well-thought-out answers, but I can, you know, I can promise that I will think it through with you. Okay.
Thank you very much. Okay. Tomorrow morning, 11.